Bill and Sally Fisher and Tom and Sue Burks. They were actually both married in 1998. And interestingly enough, Bill and Tom have similar jobs and they have the same family incomes. Both couples own a home and two cars. Both take annual vacations and overnight trips. And both eat out every Friday night for date night. It's similar in what they do, but their decisions are different. 10 years later, the Fishers had $179,000 of debt, and the Burks had $117,000 in the bank. 10 years had gone by, and they had the same income. Their incomes were similar, their bank accounts were not. And let's look at essentially what was behind that. See, the Fishers and the Burks made different lifestyle choices, and the Fishers never considered a budget important, but the Burks were very careful about their budget. And the thing that's interesting here to me is the magnitude of the difference between the two, even though they started out and during that entire time had the same family income. Back to the fact that it isn't about income, it's how we live our lives. And here are some of the details, and I'm not going to go through each one of these, but the point is that in every one of those cases, whether it be giving, housing, eating out, vacations, transportation, weekend trips, or whatever, they both did things. It's not that one family had a fun time and the other family sat home and played checkers. They both did things. It's just that one couple did them wisely and the other couple did them foolishly. And you can see some of the things all along. As an example, the Fishers bought two new cars every 5 years, whereas the Burks bought two reliable used cars every 5 years. And right on down the line, you know, one of them took an expensive vacation every year. The other couple took two modest vacations every year. They both ate out every Friday night, but one ate out at more expensive restaurants and the other kind of rotated between expensive and medium and modest. They defined their lifestyle box in a way that would create both interest in their life but margin in their finances. And that the point for bringing this out, and I actually did the calculation on all this and went through each individual thing and put in the amount they spend and when and compiled it, and that's how we got the huge difference, which over the course of 10 years was nearly $300,000 difference in the financial condition between the two couples. To say again, there is tremendous opportunity if we are but willing to take advantage of it, to live the way the Burks are living if we are currently stuck in the way the Fishers are living. And what's also interesting here, if you look at the top line, the Fishers, who were $179,000 in debt, only gave 4%. The Burks, who had $117,000 in the bank, they were tithing. So the equation really is not dependent upon scaling back on your giving. You can actually give more and live the life that the Burks are living if you take what we're talking about here to heart and incorporate that into your lives. Part of the problem, part of the reason why lifestyle adjustments are so hard is what I call the redefining of normal. The average size of an American home in 1940 was only 750 square feet. Can you imagine that? 750 square feet was the average size of an American home in 1940. And then it grew to 950, and then 1100, and then 1350, and now it's over 2300. And in fact, I think the latest statistic I heard is it's over 2400 square feet, the average American home. And that happened only since 1940. What this represents is a trend that I call the redefining of normal. Because average means normal. And as we have redefined normal, there's nothing wrong with redefining normal if normal has been redefined in an intelligent and a wise way. I'm not saying we should all live in houses that are 740 square feet. But here's the problem. We have redefined normal to where we can no longer afford normal. That's the key. In 1940, you could afford normal. Our culture has redefined normal so that normal people can't afford normal anymore. And you know how they're doing it? With debt. The gap between what you can afford and what's normal has gone to where the only way to make up the difference is debt. And so we must define normal for us, not based on what society says normal ought to be, but what is normal for us so that we can live that life that is financially free. The latest housing bubble, Jared and I were talking about this the other day, the latest housing bubble that's caused a lot of the financial difficulties we've seen economically over the last few months is as a result of the acceleration of redefining normal beyond what people can afford, even faster than what has happened. And I read this statistic just a week or so ago. In the 55 years prior to 2002, the average rate of appreciation on a house was 3%. For 55 years prior to 2002, the average appreciation on housing was 3% per year. From 2002 to 2006, it was 16%. That is a redefining of normal beyond what our incomes can handle, and the difference has been made up with an incredible amount of irresponsible debt. And anything that goes up that fast is going to come back down eventually. And what we've seen recently is some of that coming back down. And what that article also said is that even at today's housing prices, which are down in many cases by between 20 and 40%, we are still 60% higher today in housing prices than in the year 2000, which means there's still an amount of that artificial redefining of normal that's still in the system. And it just says that all that we're talking about here is even more important than it was before, because it will position you to better survive in difficult times by following some of the things that we're talking about here and how much more important it is now than ever. In 1960, which really wasn't that long ago, I mean, it may seem like it was to some of you, but in 1960, the self-storage industry was non-existent. There were no self-storage units in 1960, none. And now there are over 30,000, and it's a $12 billion industry. Because even though our houses have exploded in size, we don't even have enough room in our big houses to store all the stuff. We got to pay somebody to store it. So not only are we paying interest on the stuff we bought with credit cards, we're paying somebody down the street to store it for us. The redefining of normal. And so it's just the idea that if we don't recognize that, we can be caught up in wanting to be normal without realizing it is taking us straight down the tubes financially. And so normal has to be defined based on us and our family, not based on what's going on in the culture. Yeah. Beautiful question. Great question. I have spent a lot of time studying this. It's a very simple concept, actually. It is the transition away from the difficulty in borrowing money to where today people are trying to force borrowed money on people that don't even want it. That's been the mindset shift. And so what has happened is today there is this thought process, this wave, this cultural pressure that is essentially encouraging people to borrow more and more and more and more, because that's how you keep up and that's how you get ahead. It's a complete shift in mentality. If you go back just a few generations ago, there was this gut fear in people to borrow money. They were absolutely afraid to death of borrowing money, and when they did, they wanted to get out from underneath it as soon as possible. We've shifted from a fear of borrowing to where we view borrowing as, in fact, a vehicle to prosperity. And it is that 180-degree mindset in how we deal with debt that's caused this problem. Because now what you're doing is you are encouraging people who cannot pay back the debt to take on debt. And that, to me, is the single greatest thing that's changed. That 16% was a whole bunch of people with a whole bunch of debt and a whole bunch of money they never earned, all competing to drive up prices. And we're starting to see the tail end of that. It's a shift in the mindset. The money was always there. It's just that people who evaluated you as too risky simply kept the money. Because we created a system whereby you get incentivized by lending money to people, and you cared more about the ability to lend than you did about getting your money back, incentivized people to lend like crazy because, and this is the bottom line here, there were more rewards for lending than there were for recovering the money that you lent. That's the problem. You see how that works? That I make a commission if I lend you money, and then after I lend it to you, I package it up in a deal, I sell it to somebody else. I'm not even around whether you pay it off or not. So I am incentivized. The more money I can push off on you, I get my commission, and I'm gone. And so the system has decoupled the lending of the money with the analysis of whether I'm actually going to get it back or not. And in fact, what we're seeing now is they're not getting it back. But the people who lent the money are not the ones who were trying to collect it. So now you can't even penalize the one who lent it because he's long gone. Trying not to oversimplify a complex situation, but that's kind of what's happened. And same thing with credit card companies. If I'm a credit card company and I can charge you 22% interest, frankly, I don't much care if you ever pay it back as long as I can get enough interest from you to help offset what I might have to write off if you don't pay it back. See how crazy it's gotten? So if I offer you a credit card, I don't much care anymore if you can pay it back, which is absolutely wacko. But it's part of why we are seeing what we're seeing now. I heard this just last weekend. True story. A mom in Rochester, New York, has a 3-year-old daughter. And in the mail, she got a credit card offer to sign up for a credit card for her 3-year-old daughter. She was just getting ready to toss it in the can, and she said, "I'm going to fill this sucker out." So she filled out her daughter's name, under age put down 3, under occupation put down toddler, under annual income put down 0, and sent it in. 3 weeks later, she had a credit card. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. It didn't matter what the heck they put on that credit card application. So your question is a good one, and that's the environment that we're living in right now. And you know what? We're not going to be able to change a lot of that. What we can change is what we do to prepare ourselves not to be hurt by that. And that's why we do what we do. Because I want every one of you and everybody else to so order their financial mindset and their finances to when those kinds of things happen that you are not caught up in the backlash because you didn't prepare your own personal finances to be able to weather that storm. And that's really the only thing we can control. Okay, so I'm glad you asked that question. It really comes into play with this. And this happens with everything. It's not just houses. This happens with everything. The secret to the high-value lifestyle. See, this is why the Burks were able to save money and the Fishers were not. And it's called high-value lifestyle. And here's the definition of high-value lifestyle. It's how much real fullness and quality of living is added to your life per every dollar spent. So you're creating this relationship between money spent and the true value that comes into your life. And what you're essentially trying to do here is both shrink your lifestyle box and increase the value of your living, and do that in a way that allows you to do both. And it is possible to do both. We don't often think this way, and advertisers don't want us to think this way. But if we ever did, it would change the way we live our lives. As an example, and I'll just take myself. Every one of you, I'm sure, have the same example. There are two things I dearly love to do. I love to snow ski, and I love to play racquetball. And I do both. Our younger son lives out in Colorado, and once a year I go out there and the two of us go skiing, and I have a ball skiing. I dearly love racquetball, and I play racquetball once a week. Done that for the last 25 years, and I dearly love to play racquetball. Because I love to do both those things, it creates an opportunity for me to ask, how much quality of life has added to my life per dollar spent? And I compare the two of those. For me to do a day of skiing, frankly, is going to cost me about $400. By the time I fly out there, rent the skis, drive there, spend the day there, drive back, fly home, I'd be lucky if I get away with $400 to go skiing, and probably more than that. Now, partly I do it, too, to spend some time with my youngest son. But for $400, I had a blast skiing. But, you know, I enjoy racquetball as much as I do skiing. And you know what it cost me to play racquetball? $7 an hour. And so if I, in fact, look at those things that add the most quality of living to my life per dollar spent, I would just play racquetball all the time and not go skiing. And you know what? I would be pretty happy with that. The problem is we've got a society that not only doesn't think that way, it encourages more people to go skiing. Almost to prove that anything that costs as little as $7 an hour can't possibly be nearly as fun as skiing. You see, it's a mentality that is driving up the cost of how we live our lives without adding necessarily any additional value. The other thing would be golf versus bike riding. I love to ride my bike. And, you know, I don't golf much, but I enjoy it. The cost of going out and riding my bike for 3 or 4 hours versus playing golf for 3 or 4 hours, it's not even close. So making, I'm not saying you never golf and you never ski, but the point is when we have to make those trade-offs, let's make trade-offs not based on what they cost. Let's make trade-offs based on what adds the most value to our life per dollar spent. Okay? Yeah, I think it's as simple as that. Yep, we're just wired to do what's in our best interest rather than what's in the collective best interest. I wish it was more complicated than that, but I don't think it really is. And that's why we really need to address the issue of putting constraints around how dangerous greed can be. Right. Well, we're in theory we are. The problem is the number of people that will take seriously what we're talking about here is so small it isn't going to hurt the economy at all. Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, because we spent so long getting into this hole that it's going to take us a long time to get out of it. But under your theoretical statement, you're trying to get out of the hole all at one time, which is both impossible But yes, it would be disastrous. But because it's impossible, it's all theoretical. And, you know, it's like everything else. If everybody who's been eating Twinkies their whole life suddenly stopped eating Twinkies, Twinkies would be out of business in a month. But that's never going to happen. Theoretically, it would, but it's never going to happen. It would, in fact, have that result if it did happen, though. So you triggered the economic problem. I found the person who's to blame here. Man. Yeah, there is a long-term positive to essentially, and not to get into it real deeply, but an economy can only grow at an intelligent rate when your lifestyle increases at the same rate at which you begin to create value in an economy. So if you create 3% more value this year than last year, then your lifestyle can go up by 3%. To the degree that your lifestyle goes up by more than the value you created, then you have created an artificial gap which will eventually have to be dealt with. And we just keep postponing it off more into the future, but it will eventually cause us to have to pay the difference between true value created and the artificial lifestyle created with value that hasn't yet been produced, if you see what I'm saying. And that's, again, what we're really trying to protect ourselves from. Yeah. Yes. I do believe that. I don't know when it's going to come. It may be 20 years from now. But eventually those two lines have to come together. The lifestyle increase with the value creation have to come together. And I'm not a gloom and doom that says, you know, move to Iceland or something and buy a tent. Eventually, though, whether it happens gradually or all of a sudden, those two lines have got to come together, because you cannot live on a promise of future value forever, which is really all debt is. I promise I will create future value that I haven't yet created. Therefore, I'll increase my lifestyle in anticipation of that promise. But when the promise gets more than you can possibly ever fulfill, then the system starts to push back. And we're seeing some of that push back now. Yeah. Great questions. Okay, so following along this, I think we can take our spending and put it into three different categories, three different kinds of spending, what I call red spending, white spending, and gold spending. Red spending is where you get low life value for your expenditures. White spending would be where you get a normal or neutral, a reasonable life value. And gold spending would be where you get high value out of the expenditures. And all of our spending can fall in one of those three categories. So as an example, spending that hurts your future, red spending, a perfect example would be Eagles season tickets on the 50-yard line. Now, would that be fun? You bet it would. But would it give us a high value in exchange for the dollars spent? Frankly, not. The amount that we would have to pay for the amount of fun we got out of that would be way out of whack. That would hurt us. A new car, I'm convinced a new car falls in that category. What we pay versus the value we get out of it versus a good used car. Expensive rounds of golf, health club underutilized, expensive vacations, anything we paid too much for, all falls into this red category that is hurting our future. Because instead of putting money into the future, it's being used up today on low-value items in our life. Does that make sense? Now, white spending would be where we meet needs wisely. Reasonably priced food, property taxes, an electric bill, a lawnmower that is exactly the right size and price for the job, wisely spent entertainment, gas and vehicle maintenance, quality furniture, modestly priced, all these things represent a reasonable return on the money spent. And so they would be white spending. Question. Is a snowblower red or white? Would a snowblower be red spending or white spending? Yeah, see, all the answers are right. A snowblower in Miami, Florida, which you paid $100 for, would be stupid red spending. Okay? If you were to get a good working snowblower here for $100, would be a very good purchase. A snowblower that is a, 800 horsepower thing and you only have a 10-foot driveway would be red spending because that was a ridiculous purchase. So there isn't a blanket color for our spending until you put it in the context of how it's going to be used and what you paid for. And that's something we constantly have to be asking ourselves. Now, on the other hand, gold spending would be spending that helps our future, that has an impact on our future. Things like giving to God and others. The best investment you can make is laying up treasure in heaven. Wise investments, a 401k, an IRA, saving, an affordable home and reasonable home maintenance to protect your investment. Anything you spend to get a high value of life for low cost. And what's really interesting is how many of those things actually exist. Things like bike riding or cookout with friends or hiking or camping, playing games, renting old movies, local sports events, tailgate party before fireworks, fishing, free concerts, the zoo, canoeing, they're all over the place where you get a very high return on your time for a very small amount of money spent. The more we bring those into our spending, the better off our whole financial situation is going to be. I remember some of the things. Remember when we got all the people in the backyard to watch the NBA finals in our backyard? We still look back on how fun that was. What did we have, about 20, 25 of your friends that were in our backyard to watch the NBA finals on our big screen TV? With tiki torches and food, and that whole night was a blast for everybody. And I think it cost us, what, $3-4 for the cost of popcorn? We don't often make a connection between how much fun we have and how much we spend, and the culture, because it's in their best interest, wants us to spend as much money as possible. And that's what they're constantly pushing in front of us. So the more we think about what are those things we can do that create the greatest value in our lives for the cheapest price will be an indication of how successful we are in creating the kind of lifestyle that shrinks the box and increases our living. And so you can actually do an equation for those accountants out there, and that equation is estimate the percentages of your spending that fall in those three categories. And then the ratio of gold to red is an indication of the current state of your financial health. And the reason why that's important is you can take a snapshot now, you can take a snapshot 6 months from now, you can take a snapshot a year from now, and if you see that equation changing, you are either moving in the right direction or the wrong direction in terms of increasing both the health of your finances and the enjoyment of what you are in fact experiencing in your life. Okay? Any thoughts, questions, comments on that? Anybody ever really thought through the whole? Yeah. Well, a 401k is a bucket that holds investments. This is sometimes something that people are not clear on. 401k is just a bucket, and then you put investments in the bucket. And you can put all kinds of investments in the bucket. You get to choose what investments you put in the bucket. 401k is just a bucket which says anything you put in here, you'll get a tax advantage. So the 401k itself is neutral. What investments you put in the bucket, in the 401k, is the essence of your question. And because any investment carries with it a risk, there are times when some investments are going to go up and some investments are going to go down. What I don't want to do is get any of us to think so short-term that we end up panicking and saying, because over the last year, stocks were really bad, therefore stocks are always going to be bad. You really want to put it over a long-term range and not panic over what has happened currently, because over the course of the last 80 years, the stock market has averaged more than other investments that are interest-bearing investments. So if you've got a long time frame like you, just ride out the low times and the high times, and they will average out to being a better investment than if you just put your money somewhere and earned interest. So it really comes down to, do you have the short-term view or the long-term view? And if you're, 60, then you have to have a short-term view. But if you're in your 20s or 30s, you can afford to ride out the dips down and the dips up. So I would not say that this is the time to say I'm never going to get back in the stock market again and blah, blah, blah. Just keep contributing to your 401k, and over time I think you'll be better off than if you didn't. Okay? Something to think about. Happy is the person who wants what he already has. But unhappy and frustrated is the person who always wants what he hasn't yet acquired. It's a little bit back to the idea of comparison destroys contentment. And the idea, what are you focusing on? Are you focusing on appreciating what you have or desiring what you don't have? And the people who spend the majority of their time desiring what they don't have never get to the point where they feel contented or happy or at peace with what they have. And that's just mindset. It's entirely what mindset you're going to take, to approach this. And then our friend Paul in Philippians 4, very famous section of Scripture, but also very important. And the important emphasis here is Paul says, I have learned how to be content. And that's the key point. Paul learned contentment. It wasn't because he was naturally a contented personality. He learned contentment. He learned to be content with whatever he had. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I've learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little, for I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. Partnering with Christ in this objective is the first step in learning contentment that comes not because God desires us to live in poverty. This clearly says God does not desire us to live in poverty, because Paul had both poverty and riches. And he found himself content in both those cases. And that's the real key that comes out of this. So let's get very, very specific now and say, okay, I'm ready to start a budget. What do I do? How do I do that? What are some of the ways in which I can begin to get off of ground zero when I don't have a budget and start the process of actually getting one? And so we're going to walk through the process of actually creating a budget. First of all, husband and wife, if you're married, make sure you're committed and together before you even start. This is very important. It would be better for you to postpone starting a budget until you're both together and committed to it than to have one start it and the other one not be interested. Okay? Then you want to determine where you are now. Before you create your budget, you must have a clear understanding of what is our current situation. What are we currently spending on a monthly, quarterly, annual basis. And the only way to do that is to gather good data. And the best way to gather good data is to begin the process of writing down everything you spend for 45 days so that no matter how small it is, you write down every single thing you spend for 45 days. Then gather your past bills and receipts and anything that you have in your files that can give you an accurate picture of how much money am I spending. And where you don't have that, it's okay to use reasonable estimates. So you're accumulating the data to come up with as accurate a picture as possible of what you're currently spending. Then identify and write down your plans for the coming year that take money. What's going to happen in this upcoming year that require the use of money? And then recognize the reality and hard work of discipline and be realistic. Okay? And what you want to do then is calculate available living funds. And you get to available living funds by taking your gross income and subtracting out tithe, offerings, and anything you would give to charity, minus any taxes deducted from your paycheck, FICA, Medicare, and any other things that get deducted from your paycheck. And then deduct your savings, what you have determined you're going to save for both emergency, replacement, long-term savings. And when you deduct those three things out, what's left over is called available living funds. And available living funds basically is the size of that box. And you put a fence around the size of that box so you can then start determining how we're going to divide up the funds that are in that box. And you post those figures to a worksheet, and there is a worksheet included in your packet that looks like this. And you should have in your packet there a worksheet which lists the elements at the top that we just talked about and will get you to that starting point called available living funds. You see the two salaries, any other income, giving, taxes and other deductions, savings and 401k down to, we sometimes call it net spendable income or available living funds. It's the same term, same exact term. And so you post those things to this sheet, and then you take all of the bills, receipts, anything from your checkbook, credit card statements, anything that gives you an idea of what you're currently spending, and you review that to come up with an accurate picture of what your current lifestyle is costing you. Now, the best way to do this is to create a starting point for those things which are annual expenses and divide by 12. So let's just say you pay your car insurance $1,200 a year. You take the $1,200 divided by 12, and you would put down here 100 because that's your average monthly expense for car insurance. So you would work this up on an average monthly basis. Okay? And when you're done with this, this is your best guess of what your current lifestyle looks like given what you're currently spending today. Okay? That's the starting point. And once you've got the starting point, now you're in a position to take a deep breath, to look at it and say, given this starting point, what do I want my future, meaning next year, to look like coming off of this starting point? If you don't know where you are today, you won't know how to create what you want next year to look like. Okay, is that clear, the idea how you accumulate a picture of what you're currently spending now? Yeah. Yes. Very much so, yes. Yeah, it's very intentional. And my view of it is actually rather simplistic because I believe our giving, both biblically as well as just the way I'm wired, I believe our giving and our spending of our money directly reflects our priorities. And as simplistic as it sounds, anything I put against, put ahead of giving to God has by de facto been more important to me than God. I know that sounds overly simplistic, but my spending reflects my priorities. And if the first thing I do is give to anything other than God, he has been put in a priority lower than number one in my life. And that includes Uncle Sam. So if I'm saying I have a greater obligation to pay Uncle Sam before I acknowledge being under God's leadership with my tithe, I have essentially put God lower than Uncle Sam. And that's very meaningful to me, and I think it's meaningful biblically, because we are called to give of the first fruits of what God has entrusted to us. And first fruits denotes two different things. It denotes priority and it denotes quality. So if we are called to give of our first fruits, we are essentially called to give the first and best of everything we have. Now, the first and best means the very first thing I do is I willingly give back to God what he gave me. And because of that, the tithe on a gross versus net has never been a problem for me. It is so crystal clear, because anything less than that has knocked God down the ladder of priority to where he doesn't deserve to be. And that's why it's a crystal clear thing for me, biblically as well as how I'm wired. Some don't teach that, and I'm not sure why, just for that reason. It's a great question. Okay, so we have our starting point. Now, once you have your starting point, then what we want to do is to create some typical benchmark percentages. And benchmark percentages are just that. On an average of people throughout the U.S., these are typical benchmark percentages of what people are spending in those categories off of available living funds or net spendable income. Now, these are typical. These are not your percentages, but they're typical, which means they're a starting point. So you take available living funds, and you multiply them times those percentages to give you a starting point of what each one of your budgeted dollars might fall in those different categories. Okay? And because those add up to 100, you now have a starting point for a budget that balances, that your income is distributed among all these categories, and it balances. You've set aside giving, you've set aside saving, and you have spent in all these categories. So that's step two, is creating those typical percentages to create to work toward a first pass budget. All right? Yes. Because see these categories here? Each one of these are subcategories of the larger categories. So even though we say transportation, it's really all of the elements that allow us to be able to do transportation. Same thing with housing. Housing involves property taxes, home insurance, water and sewer, you know, blah, 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 because that's what it takes to live in that house. Okay? So once you have established the starting point, which is what you're spending now, and you calculate typical percentages, which is simply using the benchmark, then you've got two data points which you can then use to determine what you actually want to create in your unique budget using those two data points. So in this particular case, the actual housing. Well, let's take food for example. Let me back to food. On the food example, you're actually spending $400 a month. The typical benchmark percentages say that you would be at $380 a month if you're using the typical benchmark percentages. But in this particular case, you actually do believe that you could live on a budget that was actually less than that. Given your personal family situation and you're going to do some things differently, that you actually think you can commit to $350 a month. So using those two benchmarks, you plug in $350 a month as your first pass budget. and you do that for every single category, to where you simply reshuffle the typical percentages into something that makes the most sense for your particular circumstance. And that becomes the basis for your first pass budget, because it still balances to the total expenditure matching your available living funds or your net spending, net spendable income. Okay? That becomes your first pass budget. Now, because you created it in a way that doesn't give you any history of what it's like to live on that budget, as you try living on it over the next 6, 8, 9 months, you may actually have to revise it. Maybe I put too much into this and I didn't put enough into that, and you start making some revisions back and forth to move from a first pass budget to maybe a second pass and a third pass until you finally lock in on really what is the right balance between all of those accounts. And so it's perfectly okay during the first year of a budget to revise it periodically as you become smarter in terms of how you're going to spend your money. Okay? Once you have your budget, then you have to create an implementation and recording system. The budget creates the fence. What you then have to do is create a process whereby you know, am I living in this fence or not? And you need data to know whether you're in fact living within the fence. And there are two systems that we're going to talk about. One is the envelope system, and the other is expense recording sheets. Now, when I got married, my wife came from a family that didn't have a clue about money. I mean, not a clue. And so my wife came into the marriage with no financial skills at all. She wanted to learn, but she had no financial skills at all. So for the first 2 years that we were on a budget, we used a fundamental envelope system, which means at the beginning of every month, we stuffed cash into envelopes. Each envelope represented one of those categories on the budget. And we had a grocery envelope, and we stuck $300 in it. And we had an eating out envelope, and we stuck, you know, $35 or whatever. And we put money in every single envelope, and we spent cash out of the envelope, and when we got change, it went back in the envelope, and when the envelope was empty, we quit buying. And we had to stay on that system for 2 years before my wife really felt comfortable that she understood the whole budgeting thing. At that point, we then transitioned over to expense recording sheets, which we've done ever since. But in our family, the envelope system was necessary. It may not be necessary for you. You may be able to go directly to the expense recording sheets without having to do the envelope. And again, the envelope system had two things. You had this master checking account, which you created cash for the envelopes for those expenses that you paid for, and you wrote checks for those expenses that came via bills in the mail, like your mortgage. You wouldn't pay cash for your mortgage or for rent. You would write a check for that, and everything else you would convert into cash that you would take to the grocery store or whatever. The expense recording sheet, though, and I think you have a copy of that as well, is actually a very busy-looking form like this that allows you to capture an entire month of data on one piece of paper. See, and this is the beauty, that you can capture your entire financial life for an entire month on one piece of paper. Now, I know it seems so 1950 to have a form like this, and in fact it is. And the younger you are, the more out of date you think this is. And believe me, if you took my computer away from me, I would just shrivel up and die. But starting out with a manual system is another one of those things that may feel 1950s, but it is what has been proven to have yielded a much higher success rate. So my question is, do you want to be modern or do you want to be successful? And it's entirely up to you. Now, I will say one thing. The actual recording of what you spend manually for a month is, in fact, the greatest path to success. However, once the month is done, what you can do, and is what I have done for many, many years, is you take the totals in each category and you load that into some spreadsheet that you can manipulate and do trend analysis and do over and under and last 3 months and last 6 months. So it's not like we're against using the ability to calculate. What we're really trying to do is orient our minds toward financial success. And the writing it down manually does a couple of really important things. It instantly connects your brain to the process of recording it in a different way than doing it mechanically. Secondly, and this is huge, even though it may not appear huge on the surface, is if you're married, this is 1,000 times more effective because you both have equal instant access to the data. The problem with a computer is either husband or wife is the computer expert, and they're spending 80% of the time, and the other person at best might be spending 20% of the time engaging with the numbers, and it creates a whole out-of-balance situation where there isn't equal ownership and equal exposure to reality than if you have this in your kitchen drawer and every minute this is available for both of you to see at any time. Okay? So even if I can't convince you of the benefit of at least starting out with a manual system, you just got to trust me on that. I have no problem with starting out on a manual system, getting the routine down, and then transferring over to a more mechanical system or an electronic system, that's fine. I will tell you, though, that for the last 31 years, my wife and I have been using a sheet similar to this or cards that function the same way. And it's not because I never transitioned over. It's because this actually is the easiest for both of us to keep track of what we're spending. And keeping track of what you're spending is absolutely critical because the top line of this sheet is where you put your monthly budget. So if you budgeted $350 for grocery, the very top line under grocery, it goes $350. And then as you spend money during the month, you can compare what we've spent month to date with our $350. And you can not only see how you're doing versus your budget, but you can alter your spending to make sure by the end of the month you don't exceed the $350. So this sheet works the same way as envelopes. It's just that instead of the cash in the envelope, it's the cash on this sheet that constrains and dictates your spending. Okay? Yes. Right. This represents everything you spent in a category during a particular day. So you have the days of the week, days of the month on the left-hand side. So as an example, on the 5th of the month, this is a two-part sheet that you have to paste together. Is that not in there? Ah, ran the wrong sheet. Okay, here's the deal. We've got the monthly sheet in there rather than the daily sheet. So I'll reorient you all. The monthly sheet that you have looks exactly the same, except instead of the months down the side, you have the days down the side. Okay? Sorry about that. So that on the 5th of the month, let's say you went to the 7-Eleven and then you went to another grocery store, and then you went shopping at a big grocery store. At the end of the day, you would combine all three of those grocery amounts and it would go in the grocery box for that particular day. So on the 5th under grocery, you would combine those three from your receipts and put it on the grocery box. Now, by the way, I have this form, the other form, and about six other forms in an Excel spreadsheet that can be printed out so that you can print out as many of the forms as you want. And I'd be happy to email it to you. If you email me, I'll just attach it and send it back to you. Okay? So let me give you my email address right now. And if you want the spreadsheet that has all of these forms on it to easily print out, then I'll just attach it and send it back to you. So my email address is dbriggs@willowcreek.org. dbriggs@willowcreek.org. And if you just shoot me an email saying, can I have the Excel spreadsheet with all the forms on it, I'll just attach it, shoot it right back to you. That way I'll be assured that I have your right address. Then you can print out as many of these as you want. The only difference is this sheet will come out in 2 8.5 by 11s that you just have to tape together. You just have to tape it together on the back, and it'll look just like this. Okay? Sorry about that confusion, but women generally tend to save receipts so that when they go to a grocery store, they'll save the receipt, and then at night they'll take the receipt out of their purse and they will post to the box here. I developed years and years ago a method that works for me. I have a little index card. And on my index card, every time I spend money, and I think JR actually picked up this habit as well, every single time I spend money, when they're making change, I just simply write down how much it was and put it right back in my wallet. Very, very simple. Doesn't take any time at all. And then I have the data here so that later on that night, I say, oh, yeah, I bought gas for $13. I write down gas, stopped off and got some coffee, put that down, and then I scratch it off my index card, put it right back in my wallet, and it's ready to go for the next time. And it literally does not take more than just a minute or so every night. I mean, we're not talking about huge amounts of time. Just to take it from here on to here to know exactly where we are versus our budget. Yeah, if you're toast without a pen. And one of the habits both JR and I have is we feel absolutely naked if we go anywhere without a pen. It just starts getting you shaking and everything if you don't have a pen. So get in the habit of just carrying a pen around with you, and that little index card really works well. But again, some women like to save receipts, and they'll write on their trip to the grocery store, put the receipt in a pocket in their purse, and then that night they pull out the receipts. So, as an example, this is what the sheet might actually look like. And you can see the various days of the month and various categories. And it's okay to put little notes on there if you want to as well. So, as an example, under other housing on the 7th of the month, we spent $27 for a new light fixture. Well, I just wanted to remember what that was, so I wrote in there light fixture. Some things you don't have to. You know, if you buy gas, you know, $15 of gas up there. I stopped off and put a gallon and a half in. And occasionally you will have something that is so unusual that you want to mark it down, such as under repairs and other for transportation, on the 15th, we had to put some tires on the Honda. So $150 for tires on the Honda is a little note that I marked on there because I want to make sure that I knew exactly what that $150 was. So this becomes your financial life. It's all on this one sheet. And then at the end of the month, if you don't then transfer it over to an electronic spreadsheet, you can take the totals here and put them on the sheets that you do have there, which then summarize what the totals were for each month. And then you can track how you're doing against your total year budget based on the month-to-date and year-to-date totals on that other sheet that keeps the whole year straight. So you got a sheet for month, and then you got a sheet for year. And that's how you continue to check how am I doing versus my budget and can begin to make specific changes as you need to because you're getting off track with your budget. Now, every item, I'll continue to say, every item does not have to come right in on budget every month, because your budget really is a total year budget divided by 12. And there are some things you don't spend equally every month. There are many, many examples of things you don't spend equally every month. Let's just take car insurance as an example. Let's say you pay your car insurance every 6 months. You pay $600 every 6 months. Well, your budget is going to say $100 is the budget for January for car insurance, but you're not going to pay it till June. So you have a budget of $100 and expenditures of zero. So at the end of the month, you've got $100 left over. So on that sheet that tracks the different how am I doing by month, you have $100 extra dollars sitting in your budget that you didn't spend in January, which, by the way, you will have in February, you will have in March, you will have all the way until you get to June. What happens is you're going to have a $100 budget and you're going to have a $600 expense. In the month of June, you're going to be $500 under or over budget in the month of June. But when you post that to your year to date, you're going to have 5 months where you had no expense and 1 month where you had a bit expense. When you add up your June year to date, you're going to be right on 600 budgeted, 600 expense. And as you track each individual month, the budgets will eventually match with your actual. That is particularly important for something like clothes, because you may very well go 3 months and not spend hardly anything for clothes, and then you're going to a wedding or something, and you got to buy a suit. And all of a sudden, you're spending three times your monthly budget for that suit, but because you were tracking toward a total year budget and you didn't spend all you had in the first few months, you've got money left year to date to be able to cover that 1 month that you overspent because you bought a suit. And so it really is a total year target divided up into monthly buckets. Did you have something? Did I? Okay, great. Oh, no, you have to do both. Even when you do envelopes, you still need to know where your money's going, because the information you can't afford to give up. Just because there's an empty envelope doesn't tell you where did it go, and you need to know where it went. So if you do envelopes, you do envelopes and the tracking sheet. If you don't do envelopes, you create your entire control through the tracking sheet. No question about it. No question about it. Well, there are three categories here, not just two. One is you use envelopes. The other is you don't use envelopes, but you spend cash. The other is you don't use envelopes and you spend credit. You see? You're writing down what you spend here. This sheet doesn't care whether you spend cash or credit or use your charge card. It's the same. If you spend $25 in cash or $25 in credit card, it looks the same here. Right, it's totally separate. What I'm suggesting is that if you want to save money, you live on cash. It doesn't change what we do here. You're just living on cash. If, however, you want to control your spending by using envelopes, that's a separate decision, because you can control your spending through envelopes or this. It really comes down to which seems to fit best with your personality at the time you want to do it. I'm not suggesting everyone should start with envelopes unless you want to start with envelopes, okay? Because a lot of people have gone straight to this sheet, and it's worked perfectly. Yeah, so I want to push you to cash, but I'm not necessarily pushing you to envelopes, if you see the difference, okay? Great question. Thanks. Yeah, and you're the perfect setup for my next statement. I don't want you to confuse two powerful ways to save money. They're separate and they're powerful. One is spend only cash. The other is write down everything you spend. And actually, there have been people who have gone from not writing down anything to writing down everything, and they save 25% of their discretionary spending. Now, discretionary spending doesn't include your mortgage, doesn't include, you know, tithe and all that kind of stuff. But to where you have a pool of money that you can spend on anything you want to, it is not unusual for somebody who's writing down to save 25% of that discretionary pool simply because they know exactly where it's going, and that changes their habits. So perfect lead-in to my very next statement. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. I've seen that over and over and over and over again. Yeah. It is not unusual for me to come up and challenge somebody that I know does not have a budget, is not writing down, and comes to me and says, you know, I'm really having trouble making ends meet. And on occasion, I've said, okay, tell me how much you think you're spending on Starbucks or similar coffee in a month. Just tell me how much you think you're spending. Not unusual to have them say, $35, $35, $40. I said, okay, for the next 30 days, you write down every single thing you spend at Starbucks and then tell me what it is a month from now. And a month from now, that person will avoid me. And when I finally find them, I say, hey, you haven't talked to me about, I spent $115 at Starbucks. They have no concept of how much that kind of spending is just slipping through their fingers. And as soon as they start writing it down, they are shocked, as JR said, shocked at how much I'm spending at Starbucks, and it changes the way they live because they start thinking, okay, 115 times 12, I am spending more than $1,300 at Starbucks. And that causes them to have an emotional, mental change in the way they view Starbucks that never would have happened without that cheat. And so that people who are in trouble come to me and say, I am really struggling. The economy's killing me. What can I do? And I say, there are three things you can do immediately. Everybody can do starting right now. Excuse me. You can start paying cash, you can write down everything you spend, and you can start putting a budget together. And I guarantee you those three things will do more for you than if you got a second job. And so it really isn't very complicated to make an immediate change in your finances. Okay? We could probably talk about the whole budget thing for a long time. I don't want to run through it too quickly, except to say, You've got enough information in the forms and all that if you really do want to follow this process, you can successfully put together a budget, and you've got the ability to significantly change the way you view your finances. Yeah. Good. Good question. Great question. Right. That's where savings comes in. And you save two ways. You save with an emergency savings account. And the second way is that as part of building into your budget, you are building in the cost of replacing what you're currently using. Because let's take a washing machine. A washing machine isn't free. You use up a little bit of it every single month. So what you're doing is you're actually paying for the little bit you're using up every month and setting that aside in an account that is there to pay for when it finally does break. Same with your car. And so under the budget here that says under transportation, car repair, you are paying money in your car repair before your car breaks down. And you're putting that money off in an account that's sitting there, so when it breaks, you paid for it in advance. And that's the key. A budget allows you to pay for your breakdowns before they happen. And that's really the secret to why that never causes you to bust your budget. You're paying for them before they happen rather than after. Okay? Wow. That's the key to this whole idea of partnering with God. And I'm serious when I say that when we partner with God, He actually comes along and does more than we expect. Because you committed in your heart to do the right thing, He honors that, and it's really pretty fantastic. Okay, you guys let me down on the variable income thing. You were going to remind me to talk about variable income, right? Good. Okay. One guy didn't let me down. A lot of people ask, yeah, that's fine if you're working at a company and you get the same amount of pay every week, but what if I'm in real estate and I don't have a clue what I'm going to make next month because it's based on houses I haven't sold yet? So how do I budget? That really tips a lot of people over, and they say, oh, this is going to destroy my budget. Actually, it's incredibly simple if you introduce a technique to put yourself on a paycheck. And here's what you do. You estimate conservatively, to the best of your ability, it's not going to be perfect, how much you think you're going to make in the next 12 months. Let's say you're a real estate agent. You don't know when it's coming in, but you have a pretty good idea that given the current conditions and what I've done in the past, blah, 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 I think I'm going to make $60,000 this year. Again, don't know when it's going to come in, but over the course of the whole year, I think I'm going to make $60,000. You then commit to living on $5,000 a month, which is 60 divided by 12. And you create a payroll account at your local bank. And every time you sell a house, you take 100% of the proceeds and you put it into that payroll account. And you draw out of that only exactly $500, $5,000 a month, no more, no less, and you pay yourself a fixed amount out of that payroll account. So if in the month of January you sell $7,000, you put $7,000 in the account and you draw out $5,000 and you leave $2,000 there. Next month, you make $8,000. You put $8,000 in the account and you draw out $5,000. So now you got $5,000 sitting in your account. The next month, you only sold $2,000. So you put the $2,000 in, you draw out $5,000 again. And so your payroll account is the account that goes up and down, but your actual paycheck comes out of that account the same amount every single month, totally insulated from when you earned it, because you're pulling out the same $5,000 every month. And if your 60 was at all accurate, by the end of the year, that account will be close to zero, and you will have put yourself on a paycheck that was exactly $5,000 every month. And again, as long as your estimate was close on the $60,000, that'll work. Now, initially, the startup can be a little tricky if you don't already have some money funded in that account. So what I would suggest you doing initially is use some of your emergency fund to initially fund that payroll account until you get enough in there that you can pay back your emergency fund. And so you can essentially put yourself on a paycheck even though you don't earn a paycheck. And it actually works very, very well, and it's actually quite simple. Okay, any questions on that? And once you do that, then you can budget $5,000 a month irrespective of how many houses you sell, as long as you're still tracking toward the $60,000. Now, if you get halfway through the year and you realize, I'm not going to hit my $60,000, I'm only going to hit $50,000, then what you do is you give yourself a pay cut. And instead of drawing out $5,000, you now draw out $4,600, simply because that's life. And you draw out the $4,600, you redo your budget around $4,600, and you go off and do the best you can with $4,600. That really works. And it takes away the uncertainty of, am I going to have enough money next month to pay my bills if I only sell one house? Takes that problem away. It also takes away the temptation to spend that $8,000 when you had a really good month, because that'll sink you. You'll enjoy spending the $8,000, and then when you get $2,000, you're in debt. Okay? Make sense? Any questions on that? I'm glad that was the question you guys didn't ask. Does that make sense? Yeah. Well, but again, you remember what I said? Don't beat yourself up for the past. Don't beat yourself. But that really works. It really does work. And what you then do is you all of a sudden can live like a salaried employee. It really works great. And with it's so easy to set up bank accounts anymore and to actually transfer money from a bank account to a checking account, you can do that online. It is a piece of cake to do this, an absolute piece of cake. You just deposit everything into your payroll account, and then you can automatically have it go into your checking account on the first of the month for the exact amount that you budget. Works great. That was worth the price of admission, wasn't it? Yeah, you get what you pay for. Okay. And then at the end of the month, you want to summarize and discuss, identify lessons learned, make needed adjustments in spending, and pray for wisdom. And revise your budget as needed as you become smarter, which may mean actually going from a first pass to a second pass to a third pass to a fourth pass until you finally get it to where it actually best aligns with your particular spending priorities. Okay? We squeezed a lot into a short period of time. I hope we didn't go too fast. But any other things related to budget at all? Yeah, great point. Do you know the average time it takes to get a budget to balance? Now, I'm not saying this to discourage you. I'm saying this to encourage you. 9 months. You will be on it probably 9 months, if you're average, before you can finally get it to balance every single month. So don't be discouraged if after 6 months you're saying, this isn't working. No, you're right in the middle of the normal process. And again, we're not doing something for this next year. We're doing something for the rest of your life. And if it takes 9 months to develop the kind of cycle to live the rest of your life this way, that's a good investment in 9 months. Yeah, getting over the hump. Yeah. Yeah, you will have a startup period. Everybody will have a difficult startup period where you're going to be scrambling. Meaning, I guarantee you, 3 weeks after you start the budget, the transmission will go out. Just the way it works. I think it's a proverb in there somewhere. So just expect that. Expect that and realize that it's just getting over the hump to where you can begin to get a cycle to where it begins to work. And don't become, very good point, don't become discouraged when those things happen before you've completed your cycle. Okay? All right, let's take a break. Let's take another 5 or 7 minute break, and then we'll pick up and move on to the next topic.